Hello everyone, and welcome to The Mandalorians, here to discuss all things Star Wars, as you guessed, on a Monday. We explore the stories, themes, characters, and have a lot of fun along the way. This week we're discussing Chapter 23 of The Mandalorian, titled The Spies, directed by Rick Famuyiwa, and written by Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni. I am today's host, David Osgar. I have recently been covering The Bad Batch, but now this is my first foray into Mando Season 3, as Niall has caught the dreaded fan flu from a certain live event where many Star Wars fans will have gone to. I hope we have gained more listeners and more fans since we have attended, and we have our guest today was at Celebration as well, so let's get on to introductions there. So joining us is Star Wars fan and film journalist Kelechi Anulo. Hello, Kelechi.
Hey, David. How's it going?
It's going good. So yeah, how have you been? Have you recovered from Celebration? Did you get any of the fan flu? I know I've got a bit of a sniffle, but I think I've go away with it compared to Niall, who I think has actually lost his voice.
I mean, first of all, I kind of botched up the intro because I should have just done an Obi-Wan intro and like go, hello there,
you know, yes.
So
it has been done before,
I've done it. I have recovered. I was there on the Friday and the Saturday, and it was probably the most immersive and also overwhelming experience I've ever been in my life. Overwhelming in a positive sense, because it was, you know, I've been to Celebration before. I was there in 2016, and that was when, you know, they were bringing Rogue One out, and just seeing the love and adulation for Star Wars, it just felt like you're just with your community, you found your family, you know, so to speak. So coming into 2023 Celebration, we're seeing something which is, I would argue, we're heading to very much peak Star Wars at the moment, and seeing the amount of positivity, the amount of radiance, the amount of love, and just how many people you just bump into and you just make new friends, and just they're all just lovely, all just very, very positive. If I could bottle up that energy, I would, you know. So I'm treasuring every moment and memory from Celebration, and you know, if money allows, I'll be there in Japan in 2025.
Yeah, that's we have a chat group amongst many of the Mandalorians, and the picture for the group at the moment is, or you know, it's kind of titled Star Wars Celebration, and it's got the logo for the London one. And a part of me is wondering, do we just change the logo to the Japan one, as if that's the goal for everyone? It's just like, or do we kind of make it a generic Star Wars sort of picture? We'll have to decide. But yeah, it's a great time to be a Star Wars fan in that sense, especially around the time of such a big event. I'll definitely be talking more about it when we do our kind of like recap Celebration, as me, Niall and Jake, the sort of founding Mandalorians, were there at Celebration. So I'll talk about it a lot more there. Please do check out that episode. But, you know, just to touch on it, as you did there, Kelechi, I think it was really so welcoming, and it was really touching to have a experience in which it was such a community, and to be somewhere in which everyone enjoyed the same thing, because that was my first sort of big convention, full stop, never mind a Star Wars one. So it was really interesting to experience in that way. And there's so many different elements of it. You hear the celebrities speak on stage. Sometimes you see it when you're at home and you think, oh, they're just saying that. But, you know, when you hear some of the celebrities say Star Wars fans are the greatest fans in the world, etc. And when you're there, you like, you can understand that, because they are so like, you know, it's a two-way street, but the fans are so kind to the celebrities who go there, and the celebrities love meeting them. They have, you see pictures of you know, the three Ahsokas is one that springs to mind. I'm not sure if you've seen that one.
I've seen it. Yeah.
And you've got, I think, Matt Lanter, who's from Clone Wars, who said that he saw a Clovis cosplay and, you know, he got to sort of duke it out with him. So there's just so many fun things like that. And you can see why the fans love to go, but you can also see why the celebrities have a good experience with Star Wars fans, because they are all turning up at these conventions and showing their love and admiration and showing how nice they are, like you said.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you was there around the moment when they introduced Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau to the Star Wars Celebration live stage, and watching the interview and seeing Dave Filoni basically getting teared up and emotional about how much the support means to him, how much like everyone's just singing his praises, and how much he's just being able to just channel that energy into just to try and create, you know, the best Star Wars content that we're seeing at the moment, certainly in this sort of generation that we're seeing right now. I don't think there was what's the word I'm looking for? I think everyone was very emotional. You know, a tear basically actually came out of my eyes. I actually started welling up, and I'm sure a lot of Star Wars fans felt the same emotion as well, because when you see that passion and that creativity come to the forefront, and we're seeing, you know, some of the best Star Wars storytelling now just coming to fruition right now, you know, it does mean a lot. And it sees that, you just see that how much it cares, and, you know, the fans care as well. And if you think about in context with, you know, maybe some of the like the sort of online Star Wars fans, which obviously always kind of gets all the negativity, the toxicity, is like you kind of feel like, oh, that's just the Star Wars fans in a nutshell. Well, going to Celebration, it was just a great reminder that not everyone is like that. And you're seeing how everybody, like, yeah, we've got difference of opinions, but we're here for the love of Star Wars. And that was just such a life-affirming, positive experience that I've ever had. And, you know, I can't wait to see what happens next in this franchise.
I had the exact same experience. I think, like you said, it's easy to kind of see fandom or kind of like your interest in one way. And even kind of sometimes, you know, if you're not vibing or enjoying certain episodes or certain parts of Star Wars as much, it's kind of sometimes you kind of need to revisit the films or something and be like, oh yeah, this is why I like this thing. Or just, you know, why, you know, or you're just watching something and you're enjoying it and you're like, why am I such a fan of this again? And you go revisit the originals. You're like, oh my God, yes. You know, these are sort of revolutionary. This is what set the kind of template, and this is how they are able to do this great content today. And I think that, yeah, it was the same as me. It was a kind of great reminder of, like, you know, why I love it, and, you know, why, even though those criticisms, they still come from a place of kind of, you know, I want it to be the best it can be, etc. And I think that we are at a peak moment, as you said, especially for me, for Celebration. As you said, it was quite emotional in some ways. You know, Return of the Jedi is my favorite Star Wars film, so it was the 40th anniversary of that. Clone Wars, you know, I was a big fan of that, watched it throughout its like run in some ways, which I know a lot of people came back to it later or watched it since it's been on Disney Plus. So really went through the journey with that, really cherished it as that kind of like last piece of Lucas, and what it was kind of doing for prequel fans, etc. So seeing the 15th anniversary panel there, and as you said, Dave Filoni was, you know, again, got a tear out of you at the live stage. He really choked me up in the Clone Wars one, because he was talking about how he's carried that cast and crew with him throughout his entire journey. And I was just there like, Dave, get me in the feels here. And we're coming just off of Andor as well, which has got some of my favorite Star Wars moments ever. So 100. there was a lot of stuff to enjoy at Celebration. But Kelechi, as a Star Wars fan, please tell us, first of all, you know, what is it you do as a sort of film writer, etc., in a nutshell? What is your story as a Star Wars fan?
Yeah, so I'm a film critic. I work as a freelance, so if you ever around, you can catch my words in Empire Magazine, Movie Marker, Digital Spy. Was in the Daily Mirror last year as well, writing about the 60th anniversary of James Bond. And, you know, I just, for the love of film, it started from a young age, and I just wanted to just write about film, because I enjoy it. I you know, the themes that come out of it spark larger discussions and debates. And I was just really interested in, you know, the story behind the stories. And I wanted to kind of like channel that into a kind of a medium. If someone told me I'll be a film critic, I'd be like, what you talking about, Willis? Because I didn't necessarily imagine it to be kind of a film critic. But the passion of writing opened those doors to like, oh, you know what, I can actually do this and actually do this for a living. And, you know, it became much more kind of a passion because, say, I'm a Black female film critic. Representation is very, very important. And, you know, I always want to be an advocate and champion to showcase that, you know, this is, this is the way. Like, this is, you can, you know, if you're Black, you're female, or if you're a person of color or a woman of color, you know, this is a career opportunity for you because it is an avenue that you can go into. So that was kind of like my sort of my calling for it. In terms of how I got into Star Wars and, you know, why I love this franchise so much, it started off, you know, I'm going to show my age. I was about maybe about 7 or 8 years old. And my very first Star Wars film was The Empire Strikes Back. I had this kind of weird phase in my childhood where I basically watched the middle films of popular franchises. So like The Temple of Doom was my first Indiana Jones film, just for context. So The Empire Strikes Back was my first, and just being immediately falling in love with the story, the drama. I wanted to be, you know, all of my OG heroes all in one go. Like, I wanted to have the Jedi mind powers of Luke Skywalker. I wanted to have the bravery of Princess Leia. And I just wanted to have the cockiness of Han Solo, you know. So, and I wanted to be all wrapped up in one character, which was me. So, you know, as a kid, I used to like get like kitchen floor rolls and literally paint a lightsaber, like, because it just has kind of spread my imagination. And then obviously Return of the Jedi, which is like one of my favorite Star Wars films as well, which obviously at Celebration celebrated its 40th anniversary. You know, enjoyed that. And basically every time, you know, the moment that always gets me is when the Death Star gets blown up again and Lando does, yeah, you know, like, you know, and I'm celebrating right with them. So it was only like years later that I discovered like, oh wait, there's a whole other movie before then, like A New Hope. So, so we watched that, and then like I got the kind of complete sort of trilogy in my mindset. And so, you know, I've, you know, like a lot of things, you treasure it till, you know, you watch it over and over again. I watched it on VHS tape, and I was just like, I just kept on rewatching the films over again and over and over again. And then it came to, you know, I'm old enough to be in the cinema to watch my very first Star Wars films, which is the Phantom Menace, which is the prequel trilogies. Was very lukewarm on those ones, but I'll be very honest. But, you know, I kind of sort of accepted it for what it was. Yes, at times it was kind of silly. Yes, it's time. But, you know, I think it kind of got a sort of a bad rap. And I kind of, in my own defense, kind of separated myself away from the Star Wars fans because I could see the sort of level of toxicity coming towards the sort of the prequel trilogy. But what really, you know, kind of reignited sort of the love of Star Wars, and that, but you know, it's always still been there, but what always reignited my love of Star Wars was like seeing the sequel trilogy, and then when Disney Plus came, finally actually going to watch the Clone Wars, and I basically binge watched the hell out of all of those series and made me really appreciative of what the prequel trilogies were doing. And I think and it kind of came at the right time as well. It's like I felt like when I saw the prequel trilogies, maybe I was just a little bit too young to kind of really grasp everything. I was like, oh, I just wanted lightsabers. And I just realized as I got older, oh wait, there's a whole load of, you know, political story. There's a downfall of Anakin. There's corruption within the Senate. There's a whole kind of, you know, the Republic versus, you know, the Separatists and everything that is within there. You know, the Jedi, are they meant to be peacekeepers, or why are they there fighting wars? And it kind of just stemmed to a whole larger conversation about, you know, people's places in the galaxy and what they're doing and the kind of the gray areas of, you know, it's more than just the light side and the dark side of the Force. And I just kind of fell in love all over again with what these content was bringing to the forefront. So now we're kind of obviously seeing kind of coming full circle. We're seeing, after the sequel trilogy, we're now seeing The Mandalorian, we're seeing Andor, we're seeing now coming up Ahsoka, Skeleton Crew, and also now the new three announced movies. It's just a good time to be a Star Wars fan right now. And, you know, I feel like I'm just living right now my best life in terms of Star Wars and just really enjoying the ride for it.
Yeah, exactly. It's very clear and a great narrative, as you said, to sort of track in terms of like how people have experienced the franchise over the years. And there's been those sort of highs and lows. And, you know, you mentioned there about like, you know, what the sequel trilogy did. Because similar again, when talking about Celebration or just the fandom as a whole, you know, I was really there and seeing all these cosplayers and thought, what would these guys have done like 15 years ago? You know, it's, some people would have just had Lando and Leia as, a, you know, or Mon Mothma as a costume option. There's just so many more avenues we can go down now, which the animated shows, the new films, video games have all opened up, which, you know, is definitely a strength of, you know, the purchase of Lucasfilm and these new films and these new series. So while people can have their criticisms, that to me has always been one of the massive, massive pros. It's just be like, look at what we have got. Look at these characters. Look at the sort of, you know, range of stories that we're now able to tell. Look how many more people are interested in books, etc. There's a lot of people there talking, you know, really excited about the High Republic stuff, etc. And I've heard, seen and spoke to a lot of people who maybe not so much just enjoy High Republic and nothing else, but it's almost as if that is their Star Wars at the moment. They're more excited about that than they say are Ahsoka or something. So there's such a range of, you know, what people can be interested in. And as we've talked about on this podcast before, Jay calls it the buffet of Star Wars, in which you can kind of choose your dish, etc., which we've sort of alluded to many times. Tell us a bit, you know, so briefly about what's your experience has been with Mandalorian as a TV show, season one and two, and I guess Boba Fett comes into that as well, as it played such a big part in tying in different storylines, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time watching Mandalorian, that was in lockdown during the pandemic, and I had to remember sort of trying to dodge all the kind of spoilers, because obviously the United States had Disney Plus and they saw it like months earlier. So it was kind of like, oh, they spoiled Bob, Baby Grogu or Baby Yoda at that time. And I was just like, oh man, right, mute Mandalorian, mute all on Twitter. And I just remember, I think I had to put this into context. I remember watching The Rise of Skywalker and being completely deflated. Not the biggest fan of it, still not the biggest fan of it. But as we, you know, as we've seen from The Mandalorian, especially from this episode, a lot of it is heading towards that, and I'm kind of feeling a bit more better towards it. But, you know, with The Mandalorian, I thought it was just like this very fresh perspective. It's like, oh, something that is completely different. And I just immediately remember when I was watching it, you know, you kind of have the sort of Ennio Morricone kind of, you know, music kind of vibes, you know, like it's kind of like a Western, an unknown character that has got his own history. And I just remember it's just being it's just different. And it was a good different. And I remember saying to myself, you know what, the future of Star Wars is probably going to be on TV, because it will allow the full breadth. Now that's at that time when Disney Plus just launched in the UK, I just said to myself, you now got a platform that you can now really go and explore what the potential where Star Wars can go. And I think it fits in to where I think George Lucas also came to that opinion, where he said TV was where Star Wars was going to be. Obviously, it never kind of got off the ground when he was at when he was still in charge of Lucasfilm. And probably at that point, he just kind of like, you know what, the fans hate me, I can't do enough of Star Wars.
I like the idea that you almost said when he was at Lucasfilm. It's like, he was Lucasfilm.
Yeah, he was Lucasfilm.
He was like, employee.
He was employed and still, you know, still running the ship. But, you know, you're seeing, I think, the dream kind of coming to fruition. So I kind of took it in its own stride and just kind of like, I'm really enjoying these kind of half hour bite-sized kind of episodes. We're seeing, you know, the child, Baby Grogu, just making me laugh every week. And I just kind of fell in love with this story of like, here's a guy, you know, I think the first season was more or less him, Din, just going out, collecting bounties and protecting the foundling and trying to sort of get him home. second season was kind of more about building out that storyline. I think where season two and also maybe the Book of Boba Fett maybe kind of gone in a sort of a direction that not really kind of sure about that is when you've got when Din had to give up Grogu to Luke, which is obviously a pleasant surprise seeing one of my favorite characters in the universe. But you kind of got the Book of Boba Fett and we kind of put Boba Fett in one corner and then we kind of get Mando 2.5. And then we kind of feel like we're missing an entire season of where like, okay, what does Din do now without Grogu? And that kind of emotional journey and trying to kind of like find his purpose, see what he's about without the child, and then maybe come to the realization, you know what, I'm gonna go and get him back because I miss him too much. You can argue that season three kind of suffers that same situation, as in Mando and Grogu are put to one side and then we're getting Bo-Katan. But I think now that we're kind of seeing, especially after episode 7, where this now is going, I think we're now stepping into a much bigger universe and much bigger, wider world. It's not just about Mando. It's now Mando and his friends. It's Mando and the Mandalorian culture. So we're now seeing a third season where it's Mando, it's Death Watch, it's the Children of the Watch, and they're kind of like, okay, what does this culture now mean? And there are a lot of contradictions because you've got the armorer telling Bo-Katan, oh, you walk the path of both ways. Like, where Din spent like the first three episodes literally going to the bathing in the living waters.
Yeah. Just and to I get think his, in another just season, to get his she was like, she's an apostate, you know, she's yeah. like, she really offended Bo-Katan. She was like, yeah. We do not speak of Bo-Katan. And then yeah. the next minute, she's like, oh, yeah, I love Bo-Katan.
Yeah, it's like, you know, so it's interesting to see what that's becoming in terms of how do you unify a broken and fractured culture. And as we've seen from, you know, this particular episode, which for me is the game changer, you can see in the complete, as I would call it, a complete bastardization of the culture, thanks to Moff Gideon, who basically is like, I'm just going to pitch up in Mandalore, steal your resources and basically equip my army and help the Shadow Council to fulfill what is the path towards the First Order.
It's a good way of describing, I think, like you said, is that idea that, you know, Boba Fett went in that kind of direction and it's clear as to what they wanted that to be. And then season three has sort of suffered some of the ramifications of that in terms of knowing what they want the show to be. And I think also, you know, I've said before, I think it kind of does show that there is that kind of tug of war and maybe not so much too many cooks, but there's obviously a lot of voices that will come through within big franchises like this. You know, I think sometimes it does feel like, oh, the storytellers, like, especially for me, you know, like as somebody who has done film and sort of made shorts and written stuff before, you kind of think you get to the end of season two, like, oh yeah, what a perfect, like, you know, way to wrap all that up. We've started the mission and we've had this like ongoing journey. It's the hero's journey. You know, we've wrapped that up now. Where do we go next? And then they're kind of like, yep, you know, Grogu's gone now, or he'll be gone for a while. And then he kind of gets brought back in. You kind of feel like, oh, that seems like Disney coming in and saying like, well, he's really popular and he sells the toys. You need to bring him back in. And the creators kind of going, okay, how can we make this work? And maybe that's why then you watch season three. And me with my sort of business head on is kind of like, I think this is why it's happening. This is why he's in the background, because they've kind of had to shoehorn him in. And the fact that we did have quite a bit of a bigger gap between season two and three might, you know, explain some of that. But so I think that's the unfortunate thing, is once the child found his home, what do you do then, you know? And I think to me, season three almost feels like, you know, when you had those animated shows back when you were a kid, and, you know, Batman, for example, it's kind of like, you know, Batman, the animated series. And then it comes along and it's like the further adventures of Batman or something like that. This to me feels like the further adventures of Mando and Grogu, because they're kind of like, we told the story, we wrapped it up, let's just carry on doing fun adventures. And I'm like, there's nothing wrong with that. And I think that's where it comes down to, like, you know, what kind of stuff you'd like from the buffet, to go back to what I said earlier.
Yeah.
Jake, for example, loves him some pulpy Star Wars. And as somebody who loves the original trilogy and Clone Wars, sure, I love pulpy Star Wars. But as I would also say, as somebody who loves the original trilogy, those were also peppered in with a lot of, like, deep and dark elements. So Andor, except, you know, for example, Bad Batch has had a lot of like heavy themes and really complex ideas, which I've really loved.
Yeah.
And I love that kind of Star Wars. And I love how the video games have been able to explore stuff like that. So for me, the kind of pirate stuff, the kind of like creature of the week, the like, you know, like kidnapping kids or giant birds, it's just not been my vibe as much. I kind of, and I think it's more just my acceptance of, I don't know if you've had this, but originally to me, Mandalorian, like MCU shows, were like Game of Thrones, in which you were like, oh my God, this is appointment television. You needed to know what happened to Grogu. You needed to see that season finale. And that every story was so important and so big. Who's going to show up this week? You don't want to have any spoilers to let you know that Ahsoka's going to turn up. So I think that the show has also changed from that as well, in which it feels more like a kind of like Saturday morning cartoon at times, which again, not a bad thing. But it's like I've been watching it and thinking, you know what? I can maybe make some dinner at the same time as this is going on. I don't need my attention fully focused on it. But only because sometimes if it's just japes between Mando and Grogu, or they're just doing funny little things, it's like, okay, this isn't the compelling story that we sort of got used to in some ways and with other shows. And there's nothing wrong with that. So I think that, and I think a part of that is also Favreau's style. You know, I think Favreau loves that idea of like the old 50s, 60s stuff that influenced Star Wars as well, which I massively respect. But again, I think it's when I look at like, you know, my Star Wars, what I really vibe and dig, the fact that we've had like Andor, Bad Batch, all these other sort of stories, which I'm like, oh, I absolutely love this. It's just weird for me to then to be like, oh, yeah, I like this fine enough. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's different to go between, you're so used to having fillet steak, as soon as you then have like rump steak, you're like, it's still good, but it's just weird. I'm not used to not being like, I love this.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird to have that feeling of like, it's fine.
I mean, there's so many, it's hard to disagree because I think it has been a different type of season. And I think for me, it's just like, oh, this is new. This is different. Yeah. And I think it's the show in itself experimenting itself. Yes. I think we kind of got a bit of that in the Book of Boba Fett. I mean, you have to remind me of the sort of biker fixer kind of gang that the
the sort of Vespa kind of
thing. Yeah, so it was just like, oh yeah, that's completely weird, but at the same time, it's sort of George Lucas's kind of thing. It's kind of the vibe, and it's they're just chucking it in there to see what it feels like. Do you know what I mean? And I feel like they're at that position where they can do that. You know, like the previous episode to The Spies, we basically had Lizzo and Jack Black, and it was like a sci-fi police detective mystery.
Yeah,
and it evolved into kind of like conspiracy as well as unification of the Mandalorians. And it's just like, wow, that's a real head scratcher. But I loved every second of it. And I think if there is a flip side to the experimentation, and maybe this has come from the aftermath of Andor, is that I think the production design this season has been extraordinary. Yes. Like, I think the first two seasons, because it was filmed during the pandemic and there's still the kind of limitations on, you know, on how they were using the volume, like, I feel like this season has been bigger on its scale. Like, the fight scenes are looking like that cinematic. I would love to see that on a big screen. Did see that on a big screen at Celebration. You know, you're looking at a very much an expanded universe that feels like it's part production and then part use of the volume. So we're kind of getting the best of the both worlds. Yes, it's not as intrinsic as Andor, but then Andor has already a set outline and it's two seasons and that's it. They're done. Okay. That's it. There's no kind of going back from it. There's no kind of, oh, we're going to do a spin-off of this. No, that's it. Like, and I think we can treasure the moments that come out of, okay, this is everything's leading to Rogue One. How does Andor cope with these aspects of his life where he's, you know, the most wanted man in the Empire, how he got into prison, how he escaped from prison, and then becomes one of the key figures of the rebellion when we get to Rogue One. And also the characters that are introduced. I think Mando, because it's a little bit of a different flavor and a different slice of Star Wars, it can diverge in doing something a little bit different. It might not be to everyone's appealing. I think we've already established that Star Wars is for everyone, and Star Wars has different loves and affections of where people jump in and out of. But I think there is something about the curiosity of where it could go. And I think, yes, the first two seasons is very much about Mando's journey and perspective. Now it's like we're seeing, okay, where does this now go? You know, we've ended one arc. Where's this next arc going into? And again, if I'm thinking back to how Dave did the Clone Wars was filled with those like 3-4 episode arcs where it is focus and then we move on and shift gears to another thing. And it can be completely silly. It could be completely, you know, kind of serious to the Empire. I mean, even the Bad Batch this season, I felt the kind of fluctuation between like, okay, when it was on its game and it hits and it's about the Empire, that was where I wanted it to be. When it's doing, you know, little filler episodes where it's like, okay, the Bad Batch are going to retrieve this artifact for Sid and whatever.
Yeah.
Then it kind of like, oh, you know what? I just wanted to go back to what you did with Crosshair last week. Like, yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, so it's never going to be perfect and it's never going to be satisfied. And I think that is, I think, the mistake in which maybe the sequel trilogy was trying to do, was trying to please everyone. And I think in this kind of move forward that it's trying to do, and then trying to make sure that the continuity and things make sense in terms of course correcting and making sure that the sequel trilogies now make sense in terms of that understanding, that background and that story, everybody has their part to play. So it'll be fascinating. I mean, we'll see next week how it ends and see where we go with it. Episode 7 left it on a pretty much of a strong cliffhanger of where we're going to go. All roads lead to Exegol. All roads lead to the Project Necromancer. That is going to be quite interesting in seeing where Grogu, where Din, where Bo-Katan, where even potentially Ahsoka and all these other characters. You know, as much as this is a big, wide universe, it shows you that by just going and exploring the universe, how everybody sort of connects together.
I think my biggest takeaway from this episode is going to be, one, I need a t-shirt that said all roads lead to Exegol. And that should also be the next, like, album name or something. I can imagine, like, a little, like, country road and, like, a guitar.
Palpatine, maybe, like, yeah. Save me home, Exegol, where I belong.
Yes, we will go on to today's episode. But what I will wrap up what you're saying there, Kletchy, I think it is spot on. Because what I was also thinking during, again, this season and this episode, well, possibly more last week's episode, definitely, is the, like, season one of Clone Wars, for example, or even if you're looking at season five, I wasn't there watching season five going, well, where's this going? Where's this ending? Where's the storyline? What's our A and, you know, what's the start of it? Because Clone Wars wasn't that type of show. It was like arcs and, you know, like weekly episodes and different adventures each time. And I think that's where, again, like you said, that the show is course correcting. It almost makes me wish, like I said, they almost did change the name. I think they could call it The Mandalorians or something like that, just to kind of show this is where what's happening, because it's like season one and two to me is such a great, fantastic journey for that one character along with the child. And now, yeah, we have expanded and opened up and it does feel a lot more like Clone Wars, in which we're kind of trying different things and setting up different parts of the universe. And it reminds me of watching the Clone Wars movie when that actually came out in cinemas, or watching the first season of the Clone Wars, in which I'm like, what is this? Who, what? And I was like, there's a giant Jabba the Hutt, which sounds like Truman Capote, which is like got like a bar and he like smokes. I was like, and I really struggled with it, and I was like, what is going on here? But again, it's like you said, it's just the weird stuff that you can, like the Vespa bikes that you're like, okay, I'll go along with it. It's kind of the experimentation. And then lo and behold, 3 or 4 seasons later, you know, I was rewarded with that Jabba the Hutt character, was a Zero, being shot by none other than Snice Snoodles, who's also got this kind of like jazz singer thing going on, and she wants revenge on him. It's, you know, all roads lead to Zero, being shot. But yeah, I think all roads do lead to some kind of satisfaction in the storyline, or to some kind of throwback, or to some kind of redemption in some ways, if you want to call it that. Not definitely for Ahmed Best, though, as people have said, that is not a redemption arc. There was nothing he had to redeem in that. But there's definitely times in which they're kind of like the Zillow Beast in Bad Batch. They're like, oh yeah, we're just going to explain what happened to that character, by the way, from a long time ago. And also another perfect example that we've seen of the different aspects of Star Wars is Visions season two, you know.
Absolutely.
You've got Aardman there right next to, like, you know, deep dark anime, etc. So yeah, there's loads of stuff that can go on. But as for this chapter, so the spies, Kletchy, what are your overall thoughts of this episode? What are your reactions? I know possibly if we're talking about the ending, then there was a lot of dramatic reactions that people had. But when you look at the episode as a whole and your reaction to it, your takeaway, what do you think?
So for context, I was lucky enough to watch this episode with fans at Celebration.
Yes, yeah, I was going to ask about that. Yeah, actually, what that experience was like as well.
That was insane. I mean, when I normally watch Mandalorian, I'm usually at home by myself watching it and sort of reacting to it and probably causing my neighbors to, you know, like knock on my doors like, hey, you're too loud. Stop cheering. Stop reacting. Whatever, you know, I'm trying to sleep. So watching that episode with fans and we're all reacting to the same things, that was very, very special. Like, it was just incredible to be part of. And as I said at the top of this this podcast episode, if I could bottle that energy, I'll take that away, and, you know, just sample that now and again, because it was just incredible. In terms of the episode itself, I just thought it was a game changer. I think this was an episode for me that, for everyone that had questions of where this is going, where are we doing, what is Grogu's, what is Din, what is Bo-Katan, why is all these different kind of elements of these storylines keep coming together, why are we having this, to see it all now come together in this one episode, that for me, I think, was for me one of the best episodes of The Mandalorian. I think Rick did a fantastic job in terms of perpetuating the scale, the stakes, and basically where we're gonna end, where we potentially could be ending with this, which is obviously the rise of the First Order, but who is still playing this game to get to the where we see the Force Awakens. That for me is like, I think my mind exploded. I think my mind exploded from the minute one, when we had the sort of Blade Runner-esque type of opening with the Liar Kane going to an Imperial droid. And then we obviously had Moff, but obviously that was a tease, that has been teased throughout the whole series, as in he was always going to come back. But to see the Shadow Council, and then to see Hux's father and Captain Paleon, I was like, not only are we, this whole season felt like, if you watch the Clone Wars, you're being rewarded. But if you was a fan of the novels, you are being rewarded as well on this. I was just like, it was almost like it was too much to take in. Like, and that was from the first, say, 6-7 minutes of the episode, before we kind of get to the sort of the grandiose of like, okay, we've got the Mandalores, they come back, they're coming to Navarro, they're reuniting, then they're going back to Mandalore to seize it, and then we get this, basically the mic drop that, yeah, Moff Gideon has been using Mandalore as his base to basically damage the Mandalorian culture by taking the best elements of it and basically creating a whole Dark Trooper, Stormtrooper elite. And then the Praetorian Guards turned up. And I remember watching that scene with the fans, and it was complete silence. Like, he was just like, oh my God. Like, it was like the stunned shock. And then what happened to Paz? You could hear a pin drop. It was like emotionally devastating. So for me, that was Star Wars delivering everything more than my mind can comprehend.
For me, I've never been a big Mandalorian person, or I never read those books, so I've known about Thrawn. So as a Star Wars fan, I've never been like a big novel guy, to be honest. I'm very much like a visual Star Wars fan. So I think that I appreciate and understand why people get excited about that stuff, but I just personally can't, because I just don't, you know, I don't have an attachment to it. But I know that Thrawn is a cool character, and I'm happy for him to show up in that sense. So I think that's why, again, for me, this episode, I really did enjoy it. I think it is the best of season three. But again, as I said earlier, it was still kind of like, yeah, it's good, you know, I liked it. I felt this in some ways, I felt like we were building to something that didn't quite happen in some ways. But again, I don't know if that's more expectation. Like, some people have said, like, it felt like they were going to pull the rug from under you. I felt like there was something going on in which I was like, you know how it kept flipping between the armorer going up to the ship. I was like, is there some kind of betrayal going on? Because I don't know what your feelings have been on this, but I know I've had very complex conversations with Jake about it, in which people are talking about their feelings about the Children of the Watch. And again, I think that peppers my view about the show, is the like, I don't think cults are a great thing. And I'm like, when the show is kind of like, these are the good guys, and I'm like, you know, I kind of felt we were going towards a storyline of Din coming away from that, and maybe Bo-Katan being like, you do realize these guys are kind of evil. But now it seems as if the show is kind of saying, no, we're happy to show them as another faction and to kind of appreciate the way they are. And hey, you know, like Jake has said to me, you know, it is just like the world. You know, if somebody has their religious beliefs, they can be doing good things, you know, by all means. You know, I don't judge people in that way. But then when, because this, it kind of set it up as so kind of like cult-like, I think that was the difference for me. I was like, I don't quite view this as a religion. I view this very much as a kind of like damaging kind of like way of control. But this season hasn't done that. You know, I think that's where it's kind of like weird to get your head around. But I think because they focus on the armor so many times, they have these lingering shots of her throughout the episode, like, I will take them, I will come. I was like, are we leading to some betrayal? I know some people have felt it could be Bo-Katan could have turned on them, it could have been the armorer, but I guess none of it. I think, you know, the big reveal is the Moff Gideon stuff. I don't know, do you still feel that something could happen there, or do you think that's just expectation? Or
I mean I'm scared for what happens next episode. Like, yeah. I have
you
no idea.
You don't want to think about it.
I don't want to think about it. Hey, the podcast's over, guys. I'm just ducking out. but I do. I mean, if it was Bo-Katan, I don't think it was ever going to be Bo-Katan being a spy. Because if you think, I mean, again, going back to the Clone Wars, going back to even her short appearance in Rebels, we've seen what war and the infighting and the sacrifices and, you know, how much she's paid as the sacrifice. I mean, the one thing that I think maybe the Mandalorian is missing the trick is we've not had any mention of her sister, which was one of the biggest casualties from the fights and the turmoils on Mandalore.
And something which we realized at Celebration, actually, and I was like, whoa, how has nobody brought this up? She wields the Darksaber now, which is the weapon that killed her sister. Which is quite grim when you think about it. You're like, because again, I don't know if there's a kind of like revenge element to her honing that weapon. But yeah, when you think, oh, Maul, you know, spoilers, Maul kills Satine, you think like, oh, you know, red lightsaber. But then you're like, oh, wait, no, it was the Darksaber. So it's kind of weird to think she's wielding that weapon now. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I just am surprised nobody has kind of made, you know, like theory videos and like, oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I just feel like at this stage of her journey in her life, it is about trying to do the right thing. I mean, the fact that this episode, it's not perfect, but it gave us a little bit more depth of, you know, the sacrifices she made. She tried to save her people. Moff Gideon double crossed her and basically wipes out nearly all of the Mandalorian people and their culture, and basically hijacks the whole planet. So in some ways, that is where the revenge is. Like, she's coming back from Moff Gideon, and hopefully by, you know, with now the Darksaber, lead her people into a whole new generation. I think where I'm still suspect is that focused attention on the armorer, because the episode is called The Spies. The spies are always alluded to the Shadow Council. It could be just that. It could be just the reveal of Moff Gideon, the Shadow Council. It's very much evident that the previous episode where, you know, where Moff Gideon was on his transportation and then obviously found a bit of Beskar steel, it's clearly from the new stormtroopers, dark troopers that have obviously been wielding that. But I'm there in my head thinking, okay, so Moff Gideon's been messing around with Beskar steel or Beskar armor. Who's wielding it? Who's actually armoring that, you know, like melding that all together? Is there an armorer, or is someone passing on those secrets? So I'm not ruling out the armorer. I'm certainly not ruling out Axe, who basically in that gunfight is like, oh, I'm going to go call for help. And he just sort of shoots up into the sky, you know, because the Mandalorians have always been built on divisions. It's sad, but, you know, it's, you know, I kind of sort of, you know, the whole premise is that everything that they do is kind of their own volition and it's self-destructive. It's kind of a bit like me watching my football club Spurs all season. Do you know what I mean? Trying to do things and then it never works out. And it's all
the armorer
full of it.
Brings that up. You know, she says the Death Watch, you know, splintered into many factions, and then you kind of like you yourself, you kind of like go, well, which one were you a part of? You know, armorer, where did you come into this? And it's kind of, what do they believe, isn't it? Like they, in Clone Wars, they were like, there was that split, which I loved, of like Bo-Katan saying, you know, an outsider will never lead us. But then, you know, so they have the people who agree with her, like, yeah, you're right. And then there's the people who are like, no, he won the battle. He won the fight. We must be loyal to him now. So, and it's always those beliefs and that ideology that splits them. So I wonder if that, again, will become a theme. Will that become a thing? Because the Children of the Watch, like you said, this is the way they follow that so intrinsically. Yeah, I think it definitely shows a clear trajectory in terms of what is Moff Gideon's sort of plan. I guess originally everyone just kind of naturally assumed like, oh, he's the Imperial, he's just under orders of someone, he's like following Palpatine. But this very much sets it up like he's got his own agenda, you know, that there is this Shadow Council, but he's kind of like maybe trying to rule it himself. As he says, you know, like, where is Thrawn? You know, I kind of like that moment of being like, he's not on the chat, you know, where's Thrawn in the Zoom chat? You know, he's not here. And I think rightfully so, it you know, and that kind of happens in real life in some ways. The people are like, oh, this person will sort of, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, this will be the savior. It's like, well, where is that person? what are they, the one that is making this change, that they are the ones that are showing the clear leadership? And I think that is how Gideon sees himself. He's like, no, I think everyone talks up Thrawn. He's almost like Krennic in a way, I suppose, that everyone sees, you know, Thrawn is kind of like Tarkin, in which everyone's like, you must follow him, he's the heir to the Empire, he's the best of the best. Whereas I think Gideon is kind of like a confident Krennic, in which he kind of he's there asking himself, well, why can't I be the Thrawn? Why can't everyone be following me? Why does it have to be this Thrawn guy? But I think, unlike Krennic, he has got a lot more agency to be like, I am this big, I am, and I've got the legitimacy to say that. Because I wasn't even sure if at one point they were actually going to reveal he was Mandalorian or something, because credit to the guy who does say, like, are you going to give the saber back to the man who, to the person who owns it? And I'm like, wow, you really have got some gall to just say that. Like, he is, like you said, he's just using Mandalore for his resources and just being like, yeah, that sword's mine. And it's just like, what claim do you have for it? But yeah, it's again, it's the way that Giancarlo Esposito masterfully plays him as well, in which he's always had that kind of like air of arrogance and the way he says things, you know, as soon as that scene comes in. I think that's what my fear was in this season, was that once they brought him back, would he be the same? You know, would he be just a man on the run, or would he be like, ooh, you know, like a kind of mustache twirling villain, which I was behind it all along. But no, it's kind of like he's still been very similar to what he was like before, in which he's kind of given these big speeches and these monologues. It reminds me of Syndrome in Incredibles. I imagined him watching this, that especially the last scene in which he like goes up to the glass. He's like, I have been making these armies, I've been doing this. And just imagine Syndrome being like, he's monologuing. As you mentioned, some people are like, oh, is Bo-Katan taking over as the main character? I've never felt that like she was stealing the limelight or anything. I think it's been quite a natural transition. I do feel it was like maybe at the start of the season it was kind of like she was just sat there on a throne, and then she was kind of brought in a bit clunkily, in which it was like, go get Bo-Katan's help, and it's like, okay, you just saw her like for 5 minutes last time. But I think since then they've quite well established the relationship. It was quite a nice moment in this episode in which Din sort of dedicated his service to her. So yes, the season has been a lot about Bo-Katan, but I think that is to its strength, not to its detriment, because she won Katie Sackhoff is such a fantastic actress and plays the character so well, obviously knowing her so well, having voiced her as well. She looks a lot better. I think the wig is now a lot more improved. But I think again, it's like you said, is that she's got a backstory there. She, you know, she's got a sense of purpose. She's kind of got more of an arc than any other character, and a more of a trajectory. Like I was saying before, the Din was like, we must return the child in season one and two. She's almost like now taking on this kind of like journey in a way, But I think it's just been a bit mixed sometimes, in which people have been like, oh, is she evil? Is she like, is she going to betray him? Is it the armor? Is it this? But I think this episode does make clear that she is the good guy. She's the one which we are following. And Din is like a part of that, which I think is perfectly fine. And I think in some ways is almost, because some people have also said that they miss the Grogu's taking a back seat. And in some ways I agree, but I also actually think it's to the benefit of the show, because you were also talking about how big the Mandalore story is and the society. And I think if they are to go for several more seasons, I said at the end of season two, I was like, oh, will this now lead to a kind of Mandalore story? And I thought it was going to be more kind of like, oh, will Bo-Katan constantly be goading Din to fight her, and there'll be some kind of, you know, forced fight or something like that. You know, they kind of skirted around it in the whole kind of like convenient, like, oh, I was beat by that robot. It's like, okay, you know, we've brushed over that. Kind of the same with the, you know, the going to the waters. I think a lot of people have been surprised by how they kind of seem to set up something, which is like, oh, that might be the story of the season. And they're like, nope, done in season, you know, in episode two, which I'm glad of. I'm like, yes, don't stretch this things, these things out. Just get it done. But I think that Mandalore is definitely the area which would benefit the most from more series, more stories. Because as you said, when Bo-Katan is mentioning the Night of a Thousand Tears, very much like things like Order 66, we've only seen flashes of it. And you're like, well, why did that happen? Why did the Empire feel that they needed to do that? Was, you know, to you know, teach them a lesson? Were they rebelling too much compared to the rest of the galaxy? And where the armor is talking about them, you know, splintering, you kind of want to see all of that and know more about it. So I think that there's definitely room for more in the future. But yeah, ultimately, as I was saying, I think Gideon, Bo-Katan, those characters are still, you know, definitely real strengths and were fantastic in this episode. And Grogu, to me, I think almost works now if you've kind of done the whole, like, find his home thing. And if he has to stay a baby, I don't really see what more you can do with him. In a way, I think it's almost better to have him be like, he's one of the crew. You know, like when you get those sort of Disney films, etc., and you have all the different members, and there's kind of like the little kid or something, which is kind of like quiet and sort of like might be a good fighter. You know, I'm perfectly fine with Grogu being that kind of character in a way, because there's not much more you can do with a baby who ages very slowly, really, can you? Because I thought the story always would have worked best if you kind of had a time gap and then you met him when he was older or something.
Yeah. But I mean, you don't want to spoil having too much Grogu. Like, no, I enjoy when we do get those little moments, and then the moments actually matter. Like him with his beef with the Anzaleans. Like, it's still like the best bits of season three. And we're also seeing, you know, it's still bits and pieces. You know, it still kind of treads back to, I think, moments we've seen in season two where, okay, he was, you know, his journey started from the day when Order 66 happened. He was rescued. And we saw in season three who rescued him. And we're now seeing what that, I guess, what his future could be, because obviously he's now having his four sensitive powers awaken. As we saw in the Book of Boba Fett, him learning the Force, understanding the Force, and then as we've seen in season three, he's been knighted, he's been given a bit of Beskar steel, and now he's got an IG-12, like a robot. So, you know, maybe the future of Mandalore could be in the same way that Bo-Katan walks the path of two, as in can take off her helmet as well as being part of Children of the Watch. Maybe, you know, that scene where Grogu is stopping Axe and Paz from fighting, maybe he's part of that new culture of what Mandalore could be. Do you know what I mean? And it's a combination of the best bits of both worlds, as well as Grogu using and utilizing his Jedi powers, as well as, yeah, as being part Mandalore.
Yeah, and it's all questions, as you say. We'll see how it goes down. A big part of this episode is the going back to Mandalore. Eventually, you know, we see the Mandalorian fleet is in Nevarro. We get that cool moment. As you said, the visuals, you know, for Mandalorian fans, but even just for Star Wars fans in general, I was just wowed by just the scale of seeing these big, huge ships arrive on Nevarro, seeing the big, you know, Imperial ship, which has got the painting. I love how Grief is kind of just the teacher, almost as if he's like at Galaxy's Edge or something. He's like, notice the markings on this ship, and so that I thought was quite fun. They then, you know, the Mandalorians are kind of regrouping, where Bo-Katan has brought in her, I guess, whether you class them all as night owls, because later on she says like night owls with me, so I guess that's, you know, you assume, I don't know whether it's just certain what members of that are night owls like her, or whether all of them are night owls. They're sort of grouped up with the Children of the Watch, like you said, and then you kind of start to see that division a bit, but the Children of the Watch, you know, stand aside and let them arrive. They, you know, they don't sort of like immediately start fighting or anything. And then later on, we see that, you know, they start to discuss, you know, what should be the plan. And it's to go to Mandalore, send down a sort of recon squad, check out the vicinity, check it's safe while the battalion is sort of up above in space. And as Bo-Katan says, you know, many creatures have been unsurfaced since the bombing and all the damage that's happened. And we also learn that there's quite a few kind of remnants of Mandalore in terms of Mandalorians. What did you think of the whole pirate ship, you know, another pirate ship within Star Wars, and the kind of exploring Mandalore? We've done that before with the Mines of Mandalore, but this was kind of similar but also different in that we had I don't sure if you call it, they were kind of pirate Mandalorians, but they were also very much like Mad Max survivor Mandalorians, in which they kind of also had been kind of like that Bad Batch episode or something, in which they kind of had their cloaks around them and stuff because they've been forced to survive on this planet. And, you know, they said, oh, Lady Bo-Katan, we knew you would return, etc. And they were very jaded by what had happened, you know. So what did you think of that whole element?
I think it took me a while to kind of get used to, because obviously they said that all of Mandalore was, you know, purged, obviously doing the bombings and so forth. But it did kind of creep on me, like, of course there'll be survivors. Of course there'll be people, you know, who will be loyal and would stay and do their best to either protect or at least survive enough until hopefully a day where a new leadership will come, or like they'll come and reclaim it and so forth. I think it was more kind of getting used to like just almost like the scale of the purge and just how much Mandalore was just wasted in there. There's literally nothing there, and you're seeing basically a ship made out of whatever they could find just to keep afloat, to stay there. And I think I kind of got a bit emotional, because obviously they've been there for, the soldiers have been there for a long, long time, and they are just survivors. They're just there, just trying to, you know, hopefully that they will see Mandalore grow again. But at the same time, it's like, we've stayed loyal to whatever last bit of Mandalore that there is. And then they have to find out the devastating truth that it wasn't because of punishment for, you know, staying loyal to being Mandalore. It actually came a result of betrayal. And that's a new bit of information that they've had to kind of take on board to understand the culture. Now, the understanding the culture and the history now, and how this might change them for the rest of their lives and their journey. It's just very interesting to see a different side of those Mandalorians. And again, you could argue that that's another faction, that's another cult, that's another, like, we are the, I don't know how you want to call it, we are the OG Mandalores, we're the survivors of Mandalore. And if there are, you know, I think they showed maybe what, a couple, there's probably bound to be more. And then obviously there were more, because they said they would send people down into the mines and they never came back. So obviously we have to assume that's a hint to the Empire using the facility, and any trespassers, they were just immediately terminated. But I feel like it kind of sums up the entire seasons in terms of the culture of the Mandalores, and what you said, David, about myths and beliefs, and what do you believe in? Who do you fight for? Who you're loyal to? And what do you stand for in terms of the culture and belief? If you've got Moff Gideon basically using Mandalore to his own expense, then these kind of like, these survivors who have stayed loyal to Bo-Katan and just basically survived on the planet, versus the Children of the Watch, versus the Death Watch, the those clans, and where they've kind of splintered off to, you know, this is not something that's going to be healed overnight. This is not something that's going to be like, we're going to get together and we're just going to fight. Might happen in the next episode, we don't know. But we're seeing a different side of Mandalore and their story and their journey. And I think, you know, I think you have to give a shout out to Charles Purnell, because obviously he was there in Top Gun Maverick. And, you know, I was like, I was kind of like fangirling, seeing like, oh my gosh, there's, you know, there's the guy, seeing him there and being part of that Mandalorian crew and just basically sharing that journey with everyone.
And I think Niall also wanted to shout out Charles Baker, who was the other survivor who was known from Breaking Bad, etc. as well. So I think that, yeah, you got quite a few cool appearances there. And talking about the cast as well, you know, just to go back to the Shadow Council for a minute, when we have, you know, the Brendol Hux come up, you think like, my first reaction was kind of like, oh, okay, they've just got somebody who looks like that, you know, original actor who was in the film, which is Donald Gleeson. But I didn't realize this is actually Brian Gleeson who is playing that. So yeah, this is like, what, his brother is it, I assume?
His brother.
Yeah, so that's genius, because, you know, you always hope for that kind of thing. You don't want it just to be like, oh, you know, unknown actor who just happened to look like him, or we've sprayed his hair ginger, etc. For him to actually have a relation to the guy, it just perfectly tells you the story just by looks, really, doesn't it? You kind of like, oh, I think even if you hadn't been told Hux, I think even the most kind of casual of Star Wars watcher who've watched those sequel films would understand to some extent just through the way he's talking, who he's related to. And again, and it shows, like we said, you know, the fun of Star Wars, of, you mentioned, you know, the Praetorian guards coming in and, like, you know, the reaction that had. And that very much, again, reminded me of this kind of almost Marvel-esque kind of moment, or almost like what you'd get in a video game or something like that, when Vader shows up in Fallen Order, for example, of that moment of like, now this boss enters and, like, you know, like, begin, and, you know, like, it's like a Street Fighter thing in which the Praetorian guards have come in to kind of be the end fight. And it was just kind of like big Star Wars moment after big Star Wars moment after big Star Wars moment. So there was a lot of like clap, you know, fan cheering kind of moments, and very fun, especially again, if people loved that kind of Last Jedi sequence, then you get to see more of that. Or if some people felt that was maybe not as cool as it could have been, maybe this kind of was more cool, or we didn't see any action from them in the original trilogy. Well, you know, here we go. We're getting lots more of it now. And it's, I assume we'll get more in the future. So, yeah, I think it does lead to a lot of interesting aspects of this world, what the context behind what's been happening on Mandalore in the time that it's been destroyed and everyone kind of like left the planet, the sort of remnants, as you said, going underneath. Because I that was the only thing I felt with the earlier episodes, is kind of like, oh, this is fascinating going through these mines and everything, but it feels so vast and there's so much here. I kind of want to know more. So I think that this has allowed that story to be fleshed out a bit more and to add a bit more context and a bit more character to the place by understanding the sort of geography in a way, I guess. So yeah, you know, that I think was good. Obviously then later on, you know, you've got the trap and you've got the idea of like, oh, we can hear jetpacks. Is there more Mandalorians coming? But it's actually like sort of stormtroopers. What did you think of that entire sort of like end battle, in which we're getting lots of Mandalorian sort of tussles and jetpack action and knives, and one guy is just purely like throwing down a stormtrooper and just blasting him on the ground? This is, you know, this is pretty savage.
I mean, I've seen the episode twice now. I think I was still in shock because I was like, oh, there's oh, they're not Mandalore. Oh my God, they're literally stormtroopers. And you're like, oh my God, this is a trap. And I think it was more a sense of dread, because there was one point where Paz had them on, you know, with his little machine gun and clearing the deck. Next minute they were retreating and I was just like, please don't go down there. Don't go down there. Do not go down there. And then it led to this wider world where obviously you're seeing TIE fighters, TIE bombers, everything, and more Death Troopers, more Stormtroopers with their Beskar armored selves fighting Mandalorians. And I felt like I just didn't want, like, first of all, I didn't want the episode to end because I was just like, this is cool. This is absolutely crazy. I think it also kind of goes back to just like some of the battles that you see in the Clone Wars and like the battles with Mandalores and how Mandalorians fight. And that's always great to kind of see.
It reminded me very much of, like, again, when you're like running around a map on like Battlefront or something, or also the classic thing of like 1 minute they're just, because it's kind of new territory for Star Wars in some ways, you know, we all know snow planets, desert planets, but when they're kind of going through this like weird kind of like almost emeraldy kind of city place in which it's like all dark, very moody, like the idea of mines and stuff, that, you know, I think of like Lord of the Rings, you know, so it's kind of a new location, but then for them to be somewhere like that and then to turn a corner and you kind of see the Imperial corridors appear, at first you kind of just think as a Star Wars fan like, oh yeah, of course, and then you're like, well, hang on, why is there an Imperial corridor? And that's what's funny about it, is that like Gideon has set up, you know, a base there, and it's like, okay, bring in the Imperial corridors, which are now brought into to Mandalore. I just love that the designer of those corridors must be doing well in life, because they pop up everywhere.
There must be an IKEA somewhere in the empires.
Yes, yeah.
Designing all it. Flat pack
empire to go. Furniture. That's exactly what they have. And it's similar to the start again, because I was thinking with the Shadow Council, it makes me laugh that they're kind of like, even though they are the remnants of the empire, when you see an imperial officer in duty or like in a base or something, the cap and everything kind of makes sense, but when they're just there like in a call, and I'm like, do you just wear that all the time? Do you have this cap? Because to me it almost looks like you are the cadet, you know, like I don't see. And I guess in the films it makes sense, because even, you know, the admirals or the lieutenants are still under the command of Vader or someone, so it still makes sense, like having the hat and kind of being subservient, because you still aren't the big boss. You've got somebody even above you. So I just find it funny in that meeting that they're kind of still there with their coats and their caps and everything like that. And I'm like, have you just held on to that stuff? Like, do you think this is like your evil, sinister vibe?
It's
kind
of like, it's all part of the uniform. It's all part of the look. I guess it makes them feel important, which they are part of the empire.
It's like their Mandalorian armor. They're just they'll
never leave home without it.
No, this is the way. If you take off that hat, then you are for shame and you have to go. And what would be the equivalent of like taking a bath in the mines of Mandalore? Maybe going and having a stern word from the Emperor or something like that.
Well, if you're paleo, it's probably getting a stern word from Thrawn. And like, why did you tease me again? Like, we're not ready yet.
Yeah, exactly. Probably the Gideon stuff, I think we can probably touch on a bit in one of our questions today, which we had. So I'll just use this moment to kind of wrap up the episode discussion with Paz Vizsla, which I think obviously is probably, you know, a lot of people's big takeaway from this episode. Probably Kelechi, I'm assuming, adds to your element of like, what is going on? Oh my God, coming away. You know, what did you think of that moment and how the episode ends?
He fought so bravely. I think I was upset. I was upset. I mean, like, especially because he's like, out of all the Mandalorians, like the fact that this man has basically the one of the biggest machine, like, I don't know what you call it, but yeah, like machine guns, whatever you want to call it. And he's doing all of that, and he's just like literally clearing the field. It's just like, yeah, that's as you were saying, like kind of like Star Wars Battlefront. It's like, that's one of your key soldiers. Like, that's it. And considering that he's had such a journey from season one and two, being, you know, at one point the antagonist to Din, and then basically growing to friendship, and, you know, the fact that he sacrificed himself for his Mandalorian brothers and sisters, like, that's, yeah, I think it hit me harder than I anticipated. I didn't necessarily think it was going to. And then there's that brief moment where he's defeated all the stormtroopers, Baskar armor guys, and you thought, okay, he's all right. And then next minute the Praetorian guards came out, like, you know, next level boss level, and then it's just like, oh Jesus, he's dead. Like, that was like literally my first thought. And then I think I just stayed in shock, because it was just kind of like, man, y'all done him like this? Like, he's literally gone. But I guess it feeds into, you know, you got to have those kind of moments. You know, I'm not necessarily saying it had to be him, but I think it made sense in terms of like these stories. There has to be an element of tragedy. There has to be an element of who's Sakura, and the fact that yes, he could have gotten away. Yes, he laid down enough ground cover to kind of escape with Bo, but I guess he believed in the cause, or at least believed in Bo enough to say, no, you go ahead. There's too many. I will take care of this. And the fact that his final words were, this is the way, I think just made it even more powerful, his exit.
And kind of tragic, I suppose, in a way as well, isn't it? Again, that he's so invested in that belief, whether that's healthy or good or not or whatever, but it does make you kind of like be like, yeah, you know, like it again brings you back to that, even though I said before, you know, like the cult vibes, but then at the start, when the TV show started, you were all kind of like, oh yeah, this is awesome, they've got this like creed and these Saiyans and these kind of like ways of life, etc., which does make you sort of support them and kind of appreciate them and look at them as kind of like an interesting faction of Star Wars. And I think he does represent that well. Obviously, as we've said before, the armor is the one that kind of makes us question, oh, you know, what's going on here? Are they evil? What's happening? And I think that's what makes his death more tragic, is that I think if he had survived, it would have been unfortunate if he was just like, no, I was working with the armorer all along, if that was to be the decision that they made her sort of like a villain. So I think that this was more sincere and made more sense, that even he would, if something, what, like you said, sinister is going on, that he even didn't know about it. He kind of like was just like, no, I'm just the muscle guy and I will do as what I think is right. And this kind of goes back to season one, even when like they saved Din when he was sort of cornered in Navarro, when like all those bounty hunters were after him. You know, I think he'll always ultimately do what's right and try and protect the creed and just fight till the end. Obviously, he loves a fight, and I think it's like many characters we've seen, you know, it kind of reminds me of something like Dune with Jason Momoa's character in Dune, when he kind of has that same similar moment of like, you know, like I'll fend them off, and they fight to their last breath, you know, literally like taking anything they can if their weapons run out of ammo. Like, I really appreciated that his weapon overheated. Like, it was just realistic. It was kind of like, and like you said, like Battlefront, you could imagine that happening. It wasn't that he was just this unstoppable force. You know, at first he is kind of like swatting them like flies, and he's like, I'll clear you a path. And, you know, he's just able to kind of like sweep them away. But then eventually you think like that does, there's only a time limit to that. And the fact that even once that fails, he's kind of like punching them and doing everything he can, grabbing weapons. But yeah, and then once some Praetorian guards come in, then, you know, it's over. And I guess it's the way that the seasons have leveled up over time. They've had like dark troopers. What, you know, Gideon comes in. He's got an evil lightsaber. What are you going to do about that? You had like the flame trooper. Then they got the dark troopers in season two. So now I guess they're maybe setting up these Praetorian guards to be like a big fight in the final episode. But yeah, definitely a lot of questions. As you said earlier, Din has been captured. Bo-Katan has sort of like escaped with the rest and had to go off a sort of different way. And we didn't see what happened to the armorer, but from what Gideon is saying is that, you know, now they will be attacked and all of their kind of garrison is at risk. So big questions for next week, but we'll go now to our questions, which we've had from listeners and fellow Mandalorians. So because it ties in, I guess, so much with what we were just talking about, I'll first ask this question from a listener and a good friend, Reese Humphreys, who asks, do you think that Dave and John have done, how well do you think Dave and John have done in trying to excuse the somehow Palpatine has returned plotline? And I guess that everyone has speculated that that's what this whole like cloning element has been about. You know, they have said, I think to an extent recently, that like, the whole Mandoverse movie will tie up the kind of Mandoverse, but also a lot of storylines and everything will overlap even from animated shows and different things like that. And in my head, I was like, well, there's no animated show that happens around the time of that. So are you saying that, you know, there will be stuff in Bad Batch which will tie into that, which would be very plausible because it's about cloning and we're seeing the kind of like, the pieces being set up already for that storyline for Palpatine. We see Nala say, you know, what he wants is impossible. And me and Jake speculated before that that might not necessarily only mean I want to clone myself. It could mean, you know, what is his wider goal? Does he want to make like a clone society? Does he want to have like an enhanced society? People who easily take orders, or an army which will be more efficient, which won't be as sort of manipulative or easy to manipulate as the clones, I should say. And the fact that Gideon here is almost talking about the same kind of thing makes me think that, again, what you could have previously believed when they were trying to capture Grogu, and I think there was that episode in season 2 when they kind of went to the facility on Nevarro, and you saw maybe, I think, some clone in, you know, some like scary test tubes and stuff like that. You kind of thought, oh, this is all just setting up Snoke and Palpatine. But from what Gideon is saying in terms of like why he's using Mandalore, why he wants to set up like these, he wants to put himself, he was saying, into this army. My kind of takeaway from that was like, well, are you talking about cloning yourself then? Are you saying that you want to be like the perfect sort of genetic start to all these like clones or warriors? Because he obviously has this kind of like vanity issue of like seeing that like, yeah, Beskar is the best metal, Darksaber is the best lightsaber to have, you know, Mandalore is the best place to mine all of this, and if only those pesky Mandalorians would get out of the way. So I think that whereas before it seemed that like he might have just only been subservient to reaching Palpatine's goal of cloning himself. So I don't know, do you still see it as like he is still reaching that goal? Because Grogu, ultimately, they're still talking about M count and stuff like that. So it still seems to be they wanted him for his kind of force sensitivity. But now I'm like, I don't know. Even at the beginning, when he walks past those test tubes, when I kind of watched it for the second time, I was like, are there Snokes in there or are there Gideons?
I mean, I think maybe I thought when he said that, oh, I'm the best part of being in the armor is me. I thought it was more of a self-indulgent kind of thing response, rather than like, oh, he's cloning himself to kind of be in it. But I think it kind of sums up Moff Gideon, because it kind of almost now comes off as like a Mando fanboy in it. It's like, I'm gonna rip off everything that you love and turn it as an Empire's weapon. And the fact that he's studied, you know, Jedi, Mandos, I think there was another one as well, but I can't top of my head. But the fact that he seems to be gathering intelligence on what is the best potential soldiers. I think that's what he is. He's just trying to make the best potential soldiers for the Empire and basically rule in his stead. And I think when you go back to the sort of the question about whether sort of Dave and John have done a good job in terms of leading up to, you know, or at least reminding of what about Palpatine. I mean, the whole issue with the cloning has been teased pretty much since the beginning. So I feel like we're now kind of seeing it come to fruition in terms of where that next steps in that direction are going to go. It's just now a question of who's power hungry enough to actually wield what that is. What's that going to look like? It could be more Gideons. I feel like it's probably more, I kind of took it more as a self-vanity kind of thing rather than actually like, oh, he's going to be cloning himself. But I think we can safely assume that things like Project Necromancer, which Hux and Captain Palin are involved, that is the direct path to Palpatine, because they seem to have like that kind of fanboy obsession. Like, well, you know, the glory days of the Empire was ruled by the very man who gave us these powers, so we might as well bring him back. But I'm pretty sure there'll be a long, complicated road in terms of where we get to that. So the fact that we are seeing the Praetorian Guards at this moment, my assumption is that we're probably going to see the first iteration of a Snoke. And before we kind of get to a Palpatine, I feel like Snoke is at this point, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, like almost like the test before we get to a Palpatine. Just like, does the project work? And the fact that in The Rise of Skywalker, we saw millions of clone Snokes all doing their bidding and their will and so forth, kind of sees like these are the practice runs before we kind of bring out the main deal. So I would assume with the clones, it's now testing, are they obedient? can they do what they're programmed, and what is, and basically stay to their purpose, which is kind of sort of weird considering that, you know, as you and I are both fans of the Bad Batch, we've already seen how the clones have now discharged, I guess, discommissioned, I should say. And we're now ushered the era of the stormtroopers, and now they're going back to cloning. So it kind of so shows that the Empire is always finding ways to one up themselves in terms of how to beat the war.
And I think they say in Bad Batch, isn't it? You know, they don't want to destroy cloning; they want to control it. You know, they wanted to take that away from the Kaminoans. So I think again, it's this idea of like, well, the clones of Jango Fett were problematic because they were influenced by the Jedi, and you know, maybe they weren't genetically set up in the right way. But if we did it, we could do a lot better job. I think that's the difference, isn't it? Like, they would see it as like the Kaminoans made these, you know, the Jedi made these, but if we were to do it, we could do it right, kind of thing. It's which is typical of any kind of warfare, isn't it? Like, oh well, that weapon doesn't work, but if we made it, imagine what we could do with it. So I think, yeah, it is interesting. I think my immediate reaction, that was probably my tinfoil hat of like Gideon, like, oh, what could he mean? And I think it is more a vanity thing, but I think it also goes into what I was saying about when you compare him to other characters. I think that he's ultimately always going to be seeing what he can get out of it himself. As you said, with someone like Hux, they're more like committed to the cause. Whereas I think that he would be like, yeah, I will help you make this Snoke character, but what can I get out of it at the same time? How can I sort of empower myself? And I think that as we saw with Hemlock in Bad Batch, again, he talked there in that final episode about, like, you know, creating an obedient society. I think Gideon would be on board with that kind of thing. So I think it's both. I think it's kind of like the Palpatine, you know, like making the Force user wanting the M count from Grogu to kind of be able to make a cloned Force user. But then people like Gideon and Hemlock would also be interested in, oh, well, what if we could also use this to make an army or to make myself, or, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it's definitely what they're aiming for. Cloning is a massive thing.
I think it would be interesting to see how Thrawn feels about all of this stuff. I feel like, considering how Moff was acting, well, like, where is Thrawn? Like, you keep talking about him and so forth. I wonder if, like, somewhere down the line, Thrawn and Gideon will meet. And I feel like Thrawn is not going to give two shits about it. Do you know what I mean? So I feel like he's just going to be doing his own thing and just be very much calculated about the whole thing. Whereas he can probably sense that there's the vanity and the, you know, the ego that comes there. Whereas Thrawn is like, no, I'm going to play my cards and see this through.
Definitely. So our other question, again, we kind of touched on this before when we were talking before about the season as a whole, but is there anything you would say to Jacob, our listener's question, which is, would you say all the different elements of the season are finally coming together, or do you think some more work needs to be done before it gels together? Because I guess we have touched on the fact that they're trying new stuff and they are bringing in a lot of elements, especially emphasized by the fact there was an entire episode that kind of focused on a different character, which was different. But I think we've also said that, yes, there might be room for expanding the Mandalorian story for building up these other characters.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, as you said, you know, I think it's very evident that they've been experimenting, and I think there's still roads to grow out of this. I think what we're starting to see is the culmination of things starting to kind of play their part. And I think once after we've seen the finale, once we see Ahsoka, and, you know, like Skeleton Crew and all the other kind of things that are in the pipeline, we can start to kind of like see, or, you know, at least garner where we are going to be sort of replaced. But I think we're kind of on the right course in terms of doing the whole New Republic, and basically its chart of its downfall to the ushering of the First Order and how we actually got to that position. So I think there's more stuff to come, so it's getting there, and I think this was the first major step in that journey.
Definitely. And now for our fun question, which I know made you chuckle before we were recording. So one thing we didn't talk about was Grogu's new toy in this episode, which is IG-12. So he's got a new, I don't, what do we call it, like a mech? Is he now mech. Like a, is he like Pacific Rim? Is he, yeah, like a big like Pacific a Zord? Is it Power Rangers?
Power Rangers, yeah.
Grogu's now got a robot body that he can run around in, which gets over a lot of the complications of having a floating chair.
Every parent's nightmare.
Yes. Yeah. So fellow Mandalorian and host Jake asks, if you could live and move inside a droid, which one and why?
I don't know. I feel like BB-8 would be quite a cool droid to kind of, you know, run into or like be inside.
Nauseating. Like, I don't know if I.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it might be quite annoying, but I feel like, you know, if I need to get somewhere, like I can roll real kind of quick, and it's useful as well. So yeah, probably BB-8.
Yeah, I think for me, well, my first thought was just immediately, again, you know, we've talked about Return of the Jedi and stuff, and that had his 40th anniversary. And you always see the behind the scenes of 3PO and what it was like for Anthony Daniels being like in that suit. And you always watch it and think like, oh my God, yeah, imagine, you know, like having this thing strapped in. It takes hours to screw yourself in and being behind a mask, and especially in the sweltering heat. So, you know, that was not one that I would want to live in. But I think possibly I would like to see the perspective of 3PO in a way. I think that while the experience for Anthony Daniels probably wasn't pleasant, it probably has got better over the years. But I think ultimately, I don't know, actually, no, maybe I'll go back on that. I think I almost would want to see what it's like to be 3PO, even in that blistering heat, as horrible as it would be. I think that would be the most genuine Star Wars experience you could get, isn't it? To be 3PO in the desert after crash landing from
And being human cyborg relations and just like talking to everybody in that heat as well.
And being chucked into like a big Jawa tank with loads of other droids, you just wouldn't know what's going on. But because he has his little like light up eyes, being chewy on the back of his back and sort of being like, I'm backwards, I can't see what's happening, you just get such a unique view of Star Wars, wouldn't you?
Was it at one point he was a clone trooper as well in Attack of the Clones?
Like, in Attack of the Clones, he's on a droid, isn't he?
He's on a droid.
Yeah, so probably any other character in Star Wars, even R2 to an extent, you'd get kind of the same view as what you see in the films. But I think 3PO is the only one in which you would like see it from a completely different perspective, in which it would either be from somebody's back or in the sweltering heat or just as like a head on a desk or something. So yeah, I would say 3PO. I think that would be the most interesting. But so yeah, let's wrap up things, Kelechi. It's been a long conversation about all things Star Wars and Mandalorian. So what are your hopes for next time? What are your sort of final expectations of this season finale and this final episode for season 3?
I'm probably as I said before, I'm scared for what happens next week because I actually have no idea. And I think I'm just going to sit and actually just enjoy the ride for what it is. But I probably would expect a full out war between the loyal Mandos and the Empire. Considering that Moff Gideon has got his bombers and TIE fighters basically heading up to the surface, we can probably expect more surprises. So who turns up? Who might not turn up? Let's see if any fan theories are revealed. Do we get an extra spy that's basically betrayed the Mandalorians and led them to their trap? But yeah, it's all, like I said, all roads lead to Exegol.
Yes,
let's go.
Country road. So yeah, I think I'm kind of with you in terms of like I'm just gonna see where it goes and kind of like let it sort of like guide me. As we said, you know, I felt in this episode I was kind of like expectations of being like, I feel like we're building something, some betrayal or something like that, whereas I think the trajectory they possibly have gone down, I'm like, okay, I'm fine with this as well. But also I can see that happening. So I think I'm kind of in a middle ground of I could see it going either way and I could see both working. It depends on just what kind of story you want to tell. Do you want to just tell this kind of adventure story and the good versus evil? Or do you want to tell this more complex story in which it's like you said, the Mandalorians still warring and double crossing each other, etc. You know, I think either one could happen really. And I'm just kind of open to whatever they suggest. And obviously I think we're, like this episode, we're going to get a lot more Star Wars action and fun, crazy stuff, which I think will make the season as a whole quite interesting to look at. Because like I said, I think it ultimately will be, oh, that was an experiment, but it ultimately did set us on the path we're going on now. And I think we'll ultimately be, you know, fans might have their problems with the start of the series, but I think they'll ultimately be on board with what's being presented in these final two episodes.
I think it'd be interesting to see what happens to Din. And yeah, there's a part of me like, oh, someone's gonna do a rescue attempt, but wouldn't it be cool if we actually that doesn't happen and it just he's still in captive by the time we're in season 4?
Yeah, or it could even, like you said, it could be that, like, the Mandalorian, it's about all these Mandalorians. We talked about how Bo-Katan has taken this, you know, like, the spotlight in some way. Could it be that, you know, could we see a sacrifice from Din, the same as Vizsla or something? And it could be, like, this season was set up to pass over the torch or something. We'll have to see. Lots could happen. But, yeah, that's our sort of final thoughts wrapped up. We usually have like sometimes like a recommendation for people who might like what else would you suggest watching, which is not even Star Wars related. If not, you know, if people are enjoying this kind of stuff. But I think we've had so much about Star Wars Celebration and embracing all things Star Wars. And as we said, the different areas of it, and it's for everyone. I think, you know, it's important to sort of stay focused on that for this episode, especially after the big celebration we just had. So, and as we mentioned, there's a lot of stuff you can watch at the moment, including Pedro Pascal's other projects. So, Kelechi, would you have just a last minute, like, Star Wars media that you would say that if people haven't checked out, go look at?
Oh, Bad Batch, Rebels, Clone Wars. Watch the animated shows. I think they're very much underrated. And I think if you have any doubts or like, oh, you know what, I don't really know. As I said before, the curiosity's there. And if you go and actually watch Rebels and Clone Wars, Bad Batch, even to a certain extent, Visions, because that's incredible as well. I think you'll start to see the bigger picture of where Star Wars potentially is going in this New Republic era. So I'm looking forward to seeing what that is. And I hope you enjoyed the excitement and the buzz as I felt.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think also the animated shows can show you not only where they're going, but what Star Wars can be, how it can experiment. Like maybe people, like said, are a bit more on board when episodes take a diversion or have kooky ideas. You know, like the animation can often be the kind of experimental place for that. But it can also be where some of the kind of more heartbreaking or darker or lighter stories can happen. So I think Bad Batch, definitely, obviously, me and Jacob have just been talking about it for a few weeks. And I like that the Mandalorian ends, and that is your kind of suggestion from Disney Plus, is to go check that out, which I think is nice. It would have been easy for them to be like, oh, go check out Kenobi or something. So I like that they're continuing to do that. And I think if you want to be in on the cloning storyline, that is a part of this. And I think that some people might feel like, oh, it's too much, I can't watch all of it. I think I would agree, definitely go check out Clone Wars and Rebels. But I even think that you could just check out Bad Batch if you wanted to, because that series starts straight after or at the time of Revenge of the Sith. So as long as you've seen that film, you know, maybe just check out the Bad Batch arc if you just want to be introduced to the team. But I think, you know, the series still does introduce them to an extent. And yeah, it really does show, again, that idea of like forming an empire and, you know, analyzing that. What does being a soldier mean? And, you know, being a clone mean? And all the nefarious things they could be doing. So the stuff there, I think, really does, not just in a prequel sense of like, oh, this is how they built all this stuff. It's kind of like interesting and they're kind of the same thing is happening at two ends of the timeline in a way, which I think is quite cool. So, yeah, check out Bad Batch and also Visions, because the second season trailer was really cool. And that also shows where Star Wars can really be experimental and try different things. So, yeah, lots of good stuff to come in the coming months. And we'll definitely be looking forward to everyone's opinion on that, including your own, Kelechi. Thank you for joining us today. So where can the people find you? Where are you online, etc., and your work?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on this podcast. This was a real joy to record. If you want to find me on social media, you can find me on Twitter for as long as it's still in its existence, at Kate Henulo. And if you love Instagram, I'm at Special K Writes.
I think Musk is also thinking all roads lead to Exegol when it comes to Twitter.
It's leading to some destruction. I don't know what that is, but yeah.
Whether it's Alderaan or something else.
Yeah. Something else.
Maybe just Musk will be like inside Twitter, like Grogu inside IG-12. Tinkering away, but we'll just be like, no, we'll
I feel like, I feel like that's what's happening right now. Like, he's in IG-12 and he's just messing around with, like, I'm gonna mess around with this algorithm and mess around with this feature and whatever and screw up everyone's timeline. But yeah.
We'll see what happens. yeah, it's awesome. So check out Kelechi's work and also check out on social media. You can follow myself also on Twitter at David Osgar, OSGAR. You can catch my fellow Mandalorians. You can catch Niall at Niall the Glynn. You can also catch him on Letterboxd, Niall_Glynn, with an I instead of a Y, which just makes things confusing. And also Jake is at Sweaty Jake on most socials as well. You can find ourselves on Twitter at Mandalorians. And whether you use Anchor, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts, please do subscribe, follow us on there. And if you're on Apple, leave us a rating and a review, as it all helps us go up in the rankings. So, Kelechi, we used to say this is the way at the end of each episode. Each one of us would say it, and then we'd have the clip from the show. Recently, we changed up a bit more just to spice it up. But again, I'm assuming after the Vizsla thing, it's the only option, surely.
It is the only option. It is the way.
Yeah. So, this is the way.
This is the way.
This is the way.
This is the way.
This is the way.